Session number 14589, Reel 2.
Brigadier Smith, Reel 2.
They ran out of ammunition, and this Gurkha corporal, or Naik, led a charge of the Gurkhas with their kukrus, and he, I think, killed about three or four of the Greeks with his kukru. Incidentally, it's the only time in my experience, in war and after, that the Gurkhas actually used their kukris in anger. All these stories about them using kukris, I think, have been exaggerated. But in this particular instance, they had no option because they'd run out of ammunition. Anyway, this young man was awarded the IDSM. He was about 5'2", and looked the most meek individual normally, but certainly showed great courage that day.
What were the Elas like as fighters?
Well, I think they had some experienced guerrillas who'd fought the Germans in the war, but many of them had joined Elas when they thought Elas were going to win. They were fair weather soldiers, really. They were badly armed, and in most cases badly led. And once they had a setback, then their morale went very quickly.
What did their bad leadership consist of?
Well, I think you've got to examine what they did during the war. Although they did harass the Germans and carry out several specific acts against them, there's no question about the majority of them were sitting, hoping to take over as the government after the British moved out. So that they were, a lot of them were politicians rather than guerrillas. And I think this came to the fore later on.
Could you form any opinion as to what the feelings of the Greek population were at the time, whether they were against or in favour of Elas, if they'd have been able to have had a free vote?
It would be very difficult in Greece at that time to have had a free vote. It depended where you were. We then moved to Macedonia, first of all Salonika, and then up north on the border with Yugoslavia. And there were certain villages that were completely Elas. They painted all their houses red. There were some villages that were nationalists and painted their houses blue. It was very difficult to find a neutral Greek. Undoubtedly, there were neutrals somewhere, but they were very difficult for us to find them. So I think it depends where you were. As to whether you could have had a free vote then, I find it difficult to believe. There was coercion on both sides.
What did any of the Greeks verbally express any opinion about the British presence to you there?
Well, those of us we dealt with, of course, were very pro-British and were extremely glad to see us. Our problem was that when there was a truce at Varkiza in February 45, we then had the task of patrolling into the mountains, into the villages, trying to find arms and make sure the Elas laid their arms down. And we had quite a task preventing the National Guard, who had been raised in a hurry, from carrying out the sort of excesses that Elas had been carrying out before. Again, I was paying back old scores. That was very difficult. And we found the only way was to have a mixed patrols of Gurkhas and Greeks, National Guard, going into the villages. And by doing it that way, we at least ensured that nothing was carried out in the name of liberty, etc. But it's very difficult to talk about Greece without remembering how these scores they were trying to pay off against each other were over many years. And I think it's probably changed now, but it's taken them a long time because, as you probably know, after the war was over, about 1947, the Greek Civil War started, and that went on for about 2 years. And those scars are probably still there.
What did your Gurkhas make of this strange situation?
The Gurkhas got on very well with the Greeks, particularly in the villages, not so much in Salonika or Patras, but when we got to the villages, they recognised kindred spirits in many ways. They saw the poverty, they saw how hard the villagers and farmers had to work in exactly the same way as they have to in Nepal. They recognised that the Greeks were tough and liked to party and cheerful, all the sort of things the Gurkhas. So there was great affinity there. They didn't understand the politics, but to be quite frank, nor did the British officers. We had very little briefing before we went to Greece. We had to learn by experience, really. The politics was something that I've learnt to understand because I've written a book about it called Victory of the Sword. But before I'd written the book and done a lot of research, I took a very black and white view of the whole thing. Now I realise it's much more complex.
Would communism mean anything to the Gurkhas?
Not really, although now, funnily enough, in Nepal there is a communist party, but whether that's a communist party in the traditional sense, I doubt. It is a party who again the government, and they call themselves communists. So I don't think they'd know anything about the intricacies of communism in the way you and I might understand now.
By no means all people in Nepal are definitely
that. No, that's quite correct, yes. Quite correct.
How did you leave Greece?
I left Greece in 1946, which is the first time I had leave at home in the UK for 4 years. So I waved goodbye to my parents when I was 18, came back over 22 and a half. And when I left Greece, I hadn't made up my mind to be a regular officer either. In fact, I put that right at the back of my mind. My father owned a public house near Sidmouth, which you'll pass on the way to Honiton, and he was very keen that I took it over from him, but I was not married, and I wasn't really keen to bury myself in a pub at the age of 22 or 3. So I decided to take a short service commission and see what happened after that. I was also keen to be a journalist, because I've got journalists in the family and I always liked writing. So I went back to India, not really knowing what I was going to do with my life, and just having spent some time with Gurkhas, being rather fatalistic, thinking that fate might decide for me.
Now, partition occurred in India in 1947. Where were you when that occurred?
We were at a place called Junagadh, which is a small Muslim state northwest of Bombay. It was one of these cases where the ruler was a Muslim, but most of his population were Hindus. And we were, in fact, ordered to go into Junagadh to remove the Muslim leader, the Maharaja. But fortunately, there were still British officers in the top Indian Army positions then, and we didn't go in the end of that sort of mission. We went in on a peacekeeping mission only. I missed the bloodbath of the Punjab, thank the Lord. So that episode was something that I've read about but wasn't there.
So the ruler of Junagadh had opted for Pakistan?
He'd opted for Pakistan, that's correct. In the end, he fled to Pakistan, and Junagadh became part of the new India.
Were there any disturbances in the princely state whilst you were there?
There were minor disturbances, but in the main they were caused by his bodyguard, people who were Muslims, of course. and they had to be restrained, and eventually we handed over to the Indian administration that came in after us.
Can you describe any incident that happened to you personally whilst you were there at that time?
Not there. I can describe incidents at Ahmedabad, where the battalion was moved to. Ahmedabad is a big industrial city. It got a lot of Muslims, apart from the predominantly Hindu population. And there was a series of riots for about a month, I think, during the hot weather just before the monsoon. That's often happened in India. Riots tended to occur in the hottest period of the year. I think it was something to do with human nature boiling over. We were called out eventually to help the police, and I had one amusing incident, as it turned out. In those days, we had to form a square. You had one line of soldiers kneeling down. You had your best shot, who was the one who would fire at the ringleaders on orders. You had bugles blowing, banners up saying, "Stop or we fire." It was all very done in a traditional manner. The Indian magistrate had to hand over the troops before they opened fire, and it was all done by orders, single shot. One crack shot firing first, and if that wasn't effective, then one or two more men would be ordered to fire. Well, in this particular instance, I did form my company up, a howling mob about 75 to 100 yards away, I suppose. We put a white line across the road, and we put our banners up, we blew bugles. The magistrate warned the crowd again that if they didn't disperse, fire would be opened. And just before I was ordering my crack shot to fire at one of the ringleader, who was a Sikh, charged across the line at us, shouting in English, "Go home, you filthy British." And I wasn't quite sure what I should do. That wasn't in the manual of internal security. But fortunately, I had a very resourceful Gurkha officer, big Gurkha then, and he went forward, grabbed hold of this fat Sikh, turned him round, gave him a mighty kick up the bottom, which knocked him over. And to, I think, everybody's surprise, the howling mob roared with laughter, and that was virtually the end of the riot, because they then dispersed, which showed me how fickle Indian crowds and volatile Indian crowds can be. And that was an incident I put in my book, because obviously it's something I would never forget.
Which company was that?
That was B Company in the 2nd 7th. And we stayed in Ahmedabad afterwards until the Brigade of Gurkhas was split up. Two-thirds went to the Indian Army and one-third to the British Army.
So that riot must have been in May 47?
47, yes. I'm not quite sure. Probably May or June, I expect so. Yes.
What did you think about the way in which the Gurkhas decided whether to go for India or for Britain?
Well, looking back now, it was not a good way of doing it. They should have detailed, each battalion should have been said, "You are India, you are British." They'd have accepted it. That was the sensible way of doing it. But because we British have this extraordinary idea that everybody understands Western-style democracy, even though they haven't been educated in that sort of way, it was decided each man would be given an option. And after all, these guys were uneducated then. I'm not saying now, they're very sophisticated now, but they were uneducated. Their country had been a closed shop to the rest of the world. No one had asked them ever, "Do you want to do this or do you want to do that?" They were told. Their parents told them. They joined the army told them. And suddenly they were being asked, "Do you want to go this way or do you want to go that way?" And inevitably, they looked for advice from their own senior Gurkha officers or warrant officers. And those battalions that went one way, because they were led that way, and those that went the other way, went the other way. We were unfortunate because we were in Ahmedabad, a hotbed of Congress sedition. We were in a camp that wasn't fenced off or wired off from Ahmedabad itself. There were Congress agitators in our lines. We saw them. We could do very little about it. And when we had the eventual opt, apart from a solid few from B Company and another company, they went the way their senior officers told them to go. The senior Gurkha officers had been told that if they persuaded the whole battalion to go India, there wouldn't be enough Indian officers to take over the town, that they would be promoted to be fully commissioned. That was the line that was going around. It was totally wrong, but they believed it. So about 90% of the battalion opted for India, and then they became disillusioned when the Indians took them over. They didn't promote all these disloyal Gurkha officers who led them that way. They brought in their own Indian officers to command companies and run the battalion, which was quite right. And so the result is that the action of persuading the men to join India in the end was a fruitless gesture. The senior guy was the Subedar Major, the Gurkha Major, who was well educated. He had a relative working in New Delhi, and he was absolutely convinced that if the battalion went all to India, he would be promoted lieutenant colonel and command the battalion. Well, when the Indians took over those who opted for India, the first thing they did was sack him, because they said if he can be disloyal to the British, he'll be disloyal to us. And funny enough, a year or two later, when I was looking after the Gurkha transit camp in Calcutta for a short period, I was a keen soccer player in those days, so was he, and he played opposite me. He was, by that time, he was an inspector in the Bengal police. And after the match was over, having a drink with him, he said what a fool he'd been to believe this line, and he regretted everything. But I said, of course, it was too late. He threw away a very good career, because if he'd gone to Malaya with the remnants of the battalion, which then was built up, became the 2nd 7th Gurkhas again, if he'd gone with them, because he was well educated, because he spoke English, he undoubtedly would have been promoted. He'd have probably ended up as a fully commissioned major, as all his contemporaries were. So he lost out in many ways.
Now, can we go to the Malayan emergency and how you came to be involved with that, please?
Well, I didn't go to Malaya with the battalion. I went up to Darjeeling, where I did 2 years as a recruiting officer, which was probably, in my unmarried life, was the happiest period of my life, I suppose. But the battalion went to Malaya, and within a matter of weeks, the so-called emergency started, which, as you know, went on till 1958, in one form or the other. I joined the battalion in, I suppose, the end of 1949, beginning of 50. And although I didn't command a company at the beginning, but eventually did. But I did various jobs. I did intelligence officer, operations officer. I took over a company, broke my patella playing soccer, of all things, which downgraded me for quite a time. So I had to hand over the company and went back and did adjutant, which I'd done before anyway. But because I couldn't go in the jungle for quite a period of time, I was adjutant of the battalion.
When you did go into the jungle, which part of Malaya was it?
When I went in, it was a place called Kuala Kubu Baru, which is not too far from Kuala Lumpur, Selangor. And we carried out some actions there. But most of the battalion's successes came when they were operating in Pahang, which was probably the most pro-communist state at the beginning, anyway.
How did you like it in the jungle at Kuala Kubu Baru?
I don't think anyone... I think you've got to be a bit mad to like the jungle, though we had one or two officers who pretended, or certainly maintained they did. It was a strange existence. You used to go off with a big pack or rucksack on your back, not knowing when you'd be back. You were the only British officer, so for 2 weeks or however long you were in the jungle, you didn't speak any English ever, except on the wireless possibly at night. You didn't speak aloud because everything was done in a quiet whisper or with hand signals. You lived in a sort of hot, humid greenhouse of an atmosphere, so you were wet with sweat the whole time, except tonight when you took off your sweaty clothing and put on dry clothing, and then had to put the sweaty clothing on back in the morning. So it, physically it was quite wearing in many ways. Because there was only one British officer with the Gurkhas, it made sense to eat the same food as they did. Some people did take out the odd British rations, but it just wasn't worth it. And I found, being not a great rice eater, that a little rice fills me up, that I would, my Gurkha orderly would bring along a mess tin full of rice and curry, and I'd eat about a quarter of it and feel full, and he'd be rather amazed. And then about 2 hours later, I'd be hungry again. So I tended to lose weight, which is very difficult for me because I'm skinny anyway. And after about 2 weeks, I was quite glad to get out again. However, that's the physical side. Once you got into the jungle, there was always something to think about if you were the commander. By the time I took over company commander, the communist terrorists were, in the main, not carrying out any aggressive acts. They were tending to go further and further into the deep jungle. And it was a question of tracking them down. And tracking them down really meant you had to be a bit like a detective. There were signs, and if you read the signs correctly, you caught up with them. If you didn't, you didn't. And they were extremely wary. They were always on their toes, so any bold move that was noisy meant that you would never see them again for another 3 weeks or ever again. So it was... it was tricky, but it had to be done because there was no question that they were not going to give in, and the only way they were going to lose was to eventually be sought out and either captured or killed before Malaya would have peace, and that's what happened. But it took a long time.
Which year were you in the jungle at Kuala Kubu Baru?
Which year? 1954, I think I was there. I took 2 years getting myself upgraded again with my knee, which was unfortunate. So my actual company commander experience wasn't all that great. Most of my time was spent as operations, intelligence, or that sort of thing.
When you were in the jungle, did you kill or capture any of the guerrillas?
Yes, we never captured anyone. It's very difficult to capture them. The ones who were captured are usually the ones who actually surrendered before a particular action. In other words, they came out, ran away from their camps, ran away from their comrades at night, and actually came out and surrendered. But once you went into a communist terrorist camp, there was no question of surrendering then. They either ran or fought. Ran if they heard you first.
Can you describe how your unit had a success in the jungle?
We had many successes, of course. I think the perhaps most successful one, and nothing to do with me, was the most successful one, is the place called near Rompin, where one of our young company commanders discovered through a lance corporal who patrolled that there was a big camp, and it meant a very, very long, careful approach. They got stop positions round the camp early in the evening. They had to stay there all night without food or any shelter. And they went in next morning and they got most of the communist terrorists. But it was one of those actions that, without actually seeing the ground, very difficult to describe. But it was a great success. And he got the military cross for it. And the lance corporal, who really had done the most amazing patrol, he'd gone right round, he'd worked out where all the sentries were, he was able to explain to his company commander where they were, he'd found the escape routes, which they would have used if they had the chance, and on his information, it was really the plan was based. He got the DCM for it.
How good was the intelligence?
It varied. At the beginning of the emergency, the intelligence was virtually nil. We had to react to reports that were very much second-hand. There were a lot of rumours. There were unnecessary forays into the jungle based on rumours. It was only when we started, our training got better, our tactic got better. It was only when we started getting successes that the population, gradually civilian population, swung over, particularly the Chinese, because nearly all the terrorists were Chinese, and it was they relied on Chinese squatters and Chinese living in the outskirts of towns to give them food and information. Until we won those people over, we found it very difficult to get accurate information. But then as the pendulum swung, so did the information improve.
What were the main problems that you had in doing your job there?
My job as?
As intelligence officer.
Intelligence officer. Again, I think sifting the accurate from the information from the rumour was the most difficult task. Until Field Marshal Templer took over, there was no question about it that there was a lot of duplication, and we were not cooperating closely with the civil authorities and the police. They tended all to go their own way. One of the great things that Templer brought about was this triumvirate at all levels, at district, parish, higher up, state level, that the army commander, the police commander, the district officer or equivalent, they met probably every day and shared information, and eventually by doing it that way, the whole situation improved. I think Templer's part in the winning the emergency in Malaya can never be overestimated. He was a marvellous man, and he galvanised people into action, which there was a period of lethargy before that. The old colonial service were complacent. They expected to come back to Malaya after the war and find it exactly the same as it was before. And of course, things had changed. They'd been under the Japanese. The British had been thrown out and almost degraded by the Japanese. So it took